at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire may have ample amounts of clean, fresh water, but for years now, there's been concern that this resource still needs protecting. With this in mind, Governor Lynch established a Water Sustainability Commission last year. Its goal? To figure out how to maintain or even improve the state's water resources over the next 25 years. That said, there are many challenges, like changing weather patterns that have brought extended periods of drought, as well as too much rain all at once. Also, an aging water infrastructure, which received a C- from the American Society of Civil Engineers, and a citizenry that still tends to see water as a bottomless resource rather than one requiring major financial investments and a conservation mindset. Next week, in the interest of building public support for its mission, the commission will conduct conversations across the state with residents on the future of water in New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, we hold that conversation on the air with you, so let's hear from you now. What's your view of the water quality in your town or region? And how do you fix the problems with your local water? What's the solution, especially given tight budgets? Also, are the answers all about money, or are there attitudes or laws that need to be changed? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post your comments on our Facebook page. We have three guests who've all been involved in this. John Gilbert is here, chair of the Governor's Water Sustainability Commission and chair of the New Hampshire Water Council. And John, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Also with us, Paul Suska. He works on water issues at New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. And Paul, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Morning, Laura.
And also with us, Denise Hart, member of the Water Sustainability Commission, who concentrates on conservation. Denise is also chair of the commission's Public Engagement Working Group, and she's on the board of Save Our Groundwater. And Denise, good to see you, and thanks for your time.
Good to see you, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, a couple major questions before we get into some of the details of what you folks are trying to do. And John, to you first, you know, as I just said, on the face of it, it doesn't seem like we have major problems with water. We've got lovely lakes, nice drinking water. So pardon the pun, but what's below the surface here? What aren't we seeing?
Well, I think the governor is motivated primarily by the fact that we do have good quality of water and a lot of quantity at the moment. But he's concerned that there are pressures on the water systems in the state and the water resources in the state, and feels very strongly that because of the fundamental role that it plays in the quality of life in the state and frankly, in the state's economy, that it's something that we need to start thinking about now before it becomes a problem.
So pressures like what, John?
Well, I think that we've seen, as you had referenced, you know, a lot more of the extreme weather events, and that has consequences for us. If water is coming down in large quantities all at once and it's being carried away, it's not recharging groundwater. Groundwater is the source of most of our surface water flow. So there's a lot of sort of interconnected things here. There are certainly pressures building around the world about access to water. We're seeing a prolonged drought in the Midwest and the Southwest. I heard someplace not long ago that something like 40% of the existing conflicts around the world are oriented around water or access to water. So it's something that is clearly developing and is an issue that we have to pay attention to going forward.
Well, and Denise, I probably shouldn't admit this, but I will. You know, I do hear on the news about the water crises around the world and that the next fights, as John said, are going to be about water, not oil. And yet it is easy for me, probably, and others to sit back and go, thank goodness that isn't about us.
Well, that does happen in New Hampshire, unless you happen to be one of the communities in New Hampshire where your water system's been bought by one of the multinational corporations in the world. There's now an emerging market, and actually water markets and shares and water futures are starting to be sold. And New Hampshire has just about every example of this type of water privatization that you can think of. And it really doesn't come to mind unless you're one of the people dealing with it. But for instance, the Northampton public water system was sold a number of years ago, first to the Kelda Group, a British multinational, and then sold again. Now it's owned by the Macquarie Bank in Australia. And people there weren't too happy. I've been over there to talk with people, and there's a feeling that, well, wait a minute, this is our public water supply. What happens? And then there's another question, a legal question, about what happens to the state's ability to regulate water supplies when it's owned by an international company that may fall under the international trade agreements in some way. So there's a lot of layers to this, this whole question of we are a water-rich state, which is a wonderful thing, and many people are paying attention to that. And, you know, should someone be able to an entity be able to buy our public water systems that our ancestors invested in back in the late 1800s, and make that part of their, you know, market horizon? And, you know, where do, should a company be able to buy 100 acres of land and pump the water out from a community?
So, wow, that's a whole nother issue beyond the, you know, the stormwater runoff and
right.
concerns that many of us at least are familiar with. This idea of your concern, Denise, is that water has become a globalized commodity mm-hmm. and concerns for local people. And John, I know you want to jump in, but I want to get Paul in on this too. Paul Suska, you are not on the commission, but you have worked for a long time in water issues at New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. What do you see in terms of some of the threats to our water supplies? And would you say that those are more about quantity or quality?
Well, I think looking ahead, Laura, we have both types of issues. I mean, particularly now when we're getting into a drought condition, parts of this state are already in a drought condition. We need to be thinking about the summertime, the low flow periods. Is there going to be enough water in our streams to both support fish and other aquatic life, but also be available for uses such as water supply and irrigation and so forth? And there's also parts of the state where we do have water pollution. Water quality issues, or that's the term that we use, but really it has to do with the water pollution just isn't there to support the native aquatic life. And so that's something that we want to clean up. And as land gets developed in the future, that's also we need to do it in a way that's not going to create erosion and those kinds of water pollution issues.
Because if you create a road with concrete or a shopping mall parking lot with concrete, the water just rushes off instead of doing that nice slow seeping into the groundwater that, you know, that is said to replenish the water cycle and keep it all healthy and clean.
Right. There are development techniques called low-impact development that enable us to go ahead and develop without having those impacts, but they're new to a lot of people and to a lot of engineers even. So that's something that we need to change the culture around how we develop.
I just want to quickly pick up on something you said, Paul. You mentioned drought. How has this relatively mild winter and up until recently pretty dry spring affected our water?
Well, the state, parts of the state are in a moderate drought condition
really?
Already. Yep. And the northern part of the state is in the step that's not quite there. It's abnormally dry. And to the south of us in Massachusetts, they're already in a severe drought.
Parts of the state are in severe drought. You didn't have the snowpack that you usually have that
that's
melts
right.
down?
That's right. Well, the ground is very dry. The soil is very dry, even though stream flows are fairly normal and most lakes are at a somewhat normal level. This rain is getting soaked up right into the ground.
All right.
And we really need that to reduce the fire risk.
Well, I know both of you want to jump in. I also want to invite our listeners to join this conversation, though. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And as the Governor's Water Sustainability Commission gets ready to go around the state inviting citizens to participate in conversations on this topic, we invite you to join us now, 1-800-892-6477. How do you view some of the problems around water in your region of the state? And how do you propose fixing those problems? Does it take more money? Where does that money come from? Are there other solutions that aren't about money? Maybe it's just attitudes or laws that you think need to be changed. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, John Gilbert, go ahead. I know you wanted to jump in while Denise was talking about this idea that water, even here in little old New Hampshire, is a global commodity.
I think that's true, and I think it's one of the things that we need to be careful of. I mean, the history around the world has been that whenever there's some resource that somebody wants or needs for something, there's a tendency to go and mine it. And that's what we're thinking about in terms of water, you know, is that the Boston metro area, for example, continues to grow and to expand. And they've already undertaken a major project years ago to build the Quabbin Reservoir, and I can foresee that they would start looking, you know, towards our water resources up north, you know, where there is not as much population currently.
So in a free market society, can you say, no, sorry, you can't have that?
Well, that's one of the questions from a legal perspective, because this is the kind of thing that gets debated all the time under the Interstate Commerce Clause. So it's a challenge.
Interstate Commerce Clause, and also, as Denise pointed out, global trade agreements, perhaps.
Right.
NAFTA
and
so forth.
It's one of the reasons that the city of Nashua went through the recent efforts to acquire the Penichuk Waterworks, was to prevent a foreign corporation from owning that that resource as well.
You know, I want to ask you, Denise, more about your role as chair of the Public Engagement Working Group on this commission. And it's a question for all of you, but I'll start with you. So as we said, we look at the face of it. The water seems great. Seems to be plenty of it. No problem. Given that, Denise, how do you generate general public interest in this topic, you know, beyond interested citizens who work with groups like your own, Save Your Groundwater?
We've decided to work with, we wanted to, part of the executive order that set up the commission said that we needed to have public hearings in the each executive councillor district. And what we did was we overlaid those districts, the political districts, with the state's key watersheds. And that's how we came up where to hold public meetings. And then we decided to partner with New Hampshire Listens at the Carsey Institute at UNH, which has been a neutral convener of public conversations around the state on a number of different issues. And we really wanted to have an opportunity for everyday people from their communities to come in to have a conversation with people that maybe they didn't know as well about what are the water needs in our state and what do we need to do to protect them and to get there 25 years from now so that we have the same water quality and quantity that we do today.
The same or even better?
Or even better, that's right.
So, and pardon me for being a little cynical, but, you know, most people, they get home. What am I going to make for dinner? You know, what do I have to do? What paperwork do I have to fill out? What phone calls do I have to return? How do you get somebody who isn't a water activist like yourself or a business who's a major user of water? How do you encourage that person to come out to some meeting?
We have lots and lots of emails going out, personal contacts, telephoning, and the numbers are filling up. This, you do have to register for the event, and they're filling up very nicely. So people care about their water.
All right. We have a link actually on our website, nhpr.org, also on our Facebook page. If folks do want to know where these meetings are being held and when, it starts next week. We will talk more after a short break and take your calls, so stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Cole Gardens in Concord, helping families start edible gardens with herbs, vegetables, fruit trees, and advice, helping you decorate with living color, online at colegardens.com. From the University of New Hampshire School of Law, now offering a dual JD MBA program with the Whittemore School at UNH at law.unh.edu. And Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. More on using water well in New Hampshire on The Exchange on NHPR at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, New Complications in U.S.-China Relations. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy with some showers tapering off to drizzle. High temperatures near 45 north, ranging to around 55 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, using water well. We're talking about the work of the Governor's Water Sustainability Commission and its plan next week to spread out across the state, inviting citizens to participate in conversations about the quality and quantity of our water. You can join us now at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. Tell us about some of the water issues that you see in your area and what you think some of the solutions might be to those issues. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, before we go to the phones, Paul, I did want to talk to you as well about that question I asked Denise, which is, you know, beyond the environmental groups, beyond the major industrial users of water, how do you generate public interest in this topic?
Well, by asking people to think about what matters to them. A lot of people choose to live in New Hampshire because of the quality of life. A huge component of the quality of life is the natural environment, recreational opportunities, and so forth, and that depends on our water resources, not just the fact that we have lakes and rivers, but they're clean, and they're great great places to be, and also for businesses. I mean, having a great quality of life here is sort of a bedrock of our economy, particularly the tourism economy. If our lakes were all polluted, our rivers, we wouldn't be having those people streaming over the border every weekend. So it's the basis of both just quality of life for everybody, but also our economy as well.
So sometimes when we hear that a certain beach was closed due to some type of bacteria or so mm-hmm. forth, that's really bad PR, and people get upset about that.
Right. And, of course, I don't want to give the impression that we have polluted lakes and rivers or we're headed in that direction, but the idea here is to look well into the future and to make sure that what we have now is preserved and enhanced.
What do you think about this question, John Gilbert? Again, things look pretty good, so, you know, I'm not going to bother going out to this meeting tonight.
It's one of the central challenges, I think, for the work of the commission because without being insulting to people, you know, most folks, what they know about water is I turn the tap, it comes out, it doesn't make me sick, and when I'm finished with it, it goes away. And that sort of it's almost a complacency, I guess I would say, because we've had public water systems and public water infrastructure for so long that it's almost taken for granted. And I think it's, you know, it's a central strategic challenge for the work of the commission is to get people engaged. So the public engagement group is working not only to get input from citizens, but to start to stir this up as a conversational matter.
What do you expect to hear from people as you go around the state?
That's not clear to me. I mean, it's going to be very interesting. One of the process involves sending out some sort of basic factual information to people who are going to attend. And then, as I understand what New Hampshire Listens does, they're going to be asking people to talk about sort of what they value about water and trying to get some common understanding about values around water. And I think that will be very instructive for our work.
Denise, go ahead, and then Paul.
We're also going to be interested in what people don't talk about and what they don't have to say. And we're going to be paying attention to that as well. And that will help to inform the work of the commission as we move forward with developing this water sustainability management plan for the state. And it will be, we really need the public input on part of that. A little while ago, Paul was talking about land use decisions really impacting on water. And that's so true. And in New Hampshire, our land use decisions are made at the very local level, at the planning board, municipal level. But water doesn't conform to a town's boundaries.
Absolutely.
And how do we begin to think more like water and think like a watershed when we do our land use planning?
Well, and across departments, again, you work for DES, Department of Environmental Services, Paul, and I'm guessing that everybody in your department would be all over this new type of pavement
Pervious pavement.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Instead of an impervious surface like concrete where the water just goes swoosh, rushes off, it's all dirty, it doesn't have a chance to seep in, there's new pervious pavement that acts like the ground, but Department of Transportation doesn't use it.
Well, I think DOT has reservations about using it on highways, heavy traffic areas. They feel that I think it doesn't hold up. But there are other areas such as parking lots. You don't have heavy traffic, and it's perfectly suitable there.
Do you agree with that assessment, that it's not safe for roads and highways?
I don't know enough about it. I know there's a lot of disagreement on that issue. The experts, including the experts at the UNH Stormwater Center, feel that it is appropriate for even for heavy use.
All right. Well, let's get our listeners involved. Again, we're trying to have this statewide conversation about water that you guys are kicking off next week. We're kicking it off today on The Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Cindy in Newbury. Hi, Cindy. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you. This is a wonderful topic. I'm completely naive about foreign companies coming in and buying water rights. It's very concerning to me. My family grew up in Utah, and my husband and I, 6 years ago, chose to move here because of the water plentiful in New Hampshire. We were thinking about buying a house and building a house in Salt Lake and raising our family there. And when we looked around, the explosion of the population in Utah from the California people migrating east, if you're not a savvy person in Utah, you could actually buy a lot in Heber or Park City or up Immigration Canyon and realize that you don't have water rights on your property. So we decided, looking forward and having a house and having our kids go to college and staying put in one place for 50 years, that we knew water was going to be a major issue, and we've seen that in my parents' homes and the regulations of you can't water your lawns, and a lot of the lawns have now become like Arizona lawns with the rocks. So we actually chose to look out in the Northeast, and then we looked at Vermont and Maine, and we actually picked New Hampshire because we knew water would not be an issue here. So for me and my family, the idea of foreign people coming in and buying water rights here is very, you know, very, you know, nerve-wracking. And so I think it's, and thank you that you're bringing this up. And I,
well, Cindy, let me ask you a quick question if I could. And it gets to something you said a moment ago, that there were a lot of restrictions on water in Utah. Did you come here because you thought you would have freer rein to use the water resources?
Yeah, growing up in Utah, we certainly learned, you know, being there for 20 years, and I left after I finished college. Slowly, water became more of an issue. It wasn't when I was growing up, you could water your lawn anytime you wanted. Then they started restricting it, you know, depending on where you lived and what town, you could water only on one day of the week. And then slowly, things just become more and more dry. So we, you know, became more conscious of turning off the water when you're brushing your teeth and things like that. You don't leave it running. You take shorter showers and whatnot. People started learning to use more gray water for things. You started listening to people in your towns starting to do things like that. And so it just was conscious to us that this was going to be a stress for the future. And so we, living here, we certainly conserve our water. We turn off the water when we're showering. We were lathering up just because of habits that we learned growing up in Utah.
Yeah, well, Cindy, some people might say that's a good thing what Utah is doing. They're conserving the resource.
Yes, but my concern is the population has so exploded from California moving there, and our thoughts are young people trying to establish families and building homes are going to become more aware of the water restrictions, and I think that's going to push more of the people out like we chose to move here.
Boy, Cindy, thanks so much for calling. Lots and lots to follow up on there. I think to you first, John, is Utah's present New Hampshire's future? That's not what Cindy wants.
It's one of the things that we are thinking about. There are certainly major demographic shifts going on right now, the retirement of the baby boom generation, and a lot of those folks are very interested in retiring to the places that have been their sort of vacation havens. And so we're seeing a lot of development pressure in the Lakes Region areas and, you know, areas that are not well served by existing water infrastructure, which leads to, you know, more sort of individual wells, individual septic systems, and the implications that those things have. So, you know, as well as just the pressures on land development in general, which we've already talked about. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to anticipate and come up with a strategy to deal with before it becomes the kind of condition that we have in Utah.
It's interesting, too. Denise talked earlier about, or one of you did, talked about global pressures and that already around the world we talk about fights over water and how that's going to be the major source of conflict in the future. And Cindy's describing some of that happening already here in this country, Denise. I wonder what you think, though. You know, she said, yes, we try to conserve our water, but she also sounded kind of annoyed by some of these measures that Utah had to take. What do you think?
I think conserving water use is always a good idea. And you have to...
Even when it's plentiful.
Because many of us in New Hampshire rely on private wells for our water, and that depends on how we all use our water and who's drawing out of... Usually it's a groundwater well and who's drawing out of the aquifer. So it's always a good idea to conserve water, number one. And the question I always ask when I go out on public speaking is I ask people, do you know where your water comes from? And it leads to some really interesting answers. If you're on city water, people will usually say, well, you know, it comes from Manchester. I open the tap and there it is. If you're on well water, a lot of times people know a little bit more, or maybe they don't. Maybe they haven't tested their well even in 4 or 5 years, which is not a good idea when you're running your own water system. So conserving your water is always a good idea. And we need to learn more about how to do that efficiently and promote it. Just because we have abundance here in New Hampshire doesn't mean we have to not care for it.
Paul, love your thoughts on some of the issues that Cindy raised as well.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, water conflicts are nothing new. They've been around for a long, long time. There's a really interesting website called the Water Conflict Chronology, and part of what they have is a map of the U.S. or map of the world. There's one point in New Hampshire for a water conflict, and it goes back to the mid-1800s when there was a conflict between the dam, the owners of the dam, the people who wanted to keep the water in the lakes, and the mill owners downstream. But as far as what Denise said about conserving water, it is a great idea all the time because water is energy. A huge amount of the energy that we use as a nation goes into pumping water out of the ground, treating wastewater. So saving water means saving energy.
She also mentioned, you know, and I know other people feel this way too, so I'm not picking on her. She didn't like letting the lawn go all dry. She didn't like having to, you know, monitor taking a short shower and so forth. I'm wondering if you would say, no, those are good things.
Well, it's an idea that we probably need to get used to happening once in a while and perhaps happening more frequently as our precipitation patterns change. Municipalities now have the authority to restrict water use, even water use from private wells, at times of drought. And so do water systems. So I think as we get into more frequent drought conditions, we're going to experience some of those water use restrictions.
Boy, when you talk about people's lawns, John, it gets really touchy, okay? I used to do this morning running loop in my neighborhood one summer, and it was a particularly rainy summer a couple years back. So it was drizzling or raining, you know, almost every day for the whole month of June or something. And there was this one house I used to run by, and every morning they had the sprinkler on. And it was raining and raining and raining. I wanted to just knock on these people's door and say, do you know it's raining out? Maybe you don't need the sprinkler on. This gets to that whole, you know, even though it seems plentiful, maybe we could preserve it a little.
Well, think about the experience with gasoline. I mean, we have for many years enjoyed low prices for gasoline and perhaps people would argue artificially low prices. Over the recent years, that's not been the case. So think about how people have started adapting their behavior to the fact that gasoline prices have started to rise. You know, you think about combining your trips. You think about getting a more efficient car. You think about ways that you can conserve the way you use gasoline so that you keep the costs down. One of the issues that we think is important with water is that the costs have been relatively low. We've been basically paying for operating costs for infrastructure, and we haven't been accruing the money that we need to repair infrastructure. And so I'm sure that people are aware now that the water infrastructure is a major issue for the state with a very high price tag for systems that are getting quite elderly and over capacity.
Well, and I definitely want to hit on that with all three of you because we hear that some of the pipes maybe even date back to around the Civil War era. That might be an exaggeration. I'm not sure. But one more question about this use ethic for you, Paul. I mentioned the house I used to run past that would have the sprinkler going on every morning, even though it was raining every single day. In one sense, yeah, you could go, why is that person doing that? But in another sense, isn't it all part of that water cycle that we learn about in, you know, high school or middle school? And it goes into the ground and it goes through this cycle and it goes back, evaporates back into the air. So maybe that's okay that that house was watering the lawn while it was raining out.
Well, it depends on where the water's coming from and where it's going. If it's ending up on the pavement, it's not going back into the ground. It's probably running off into a storm sewer system in the city of Concord and into the Merrimack River. And in terms of where it's coming from, if, as Denise described, I think earlier, if you're on a private well, you're taking water out of that well and putting it right back into your own lawn, it's a much tighter loop as long as you don't have a lot of loss to evaporation. And during the summer, depending on what time of day you're watering, you're going to have a lot of loss to evaporation. So it's not simply that cycle you described, out of the ground and back into the ground.
But if it evaporates, doesn't it eventually go into that, again, that famous water cycle of, you know, condensation, evaporation, and so forth?
Oh, it'll come back to the ground someplace, but it could be very far away. It could be over the ocean, so.
All right, let's take another call. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Heather's waiting in Brookline. Hi, Heather. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Absolutely right. I'm from Brookline. You know, we're a small town but rapidly growing or have been that relies on well water. And so, personally, I have some concerns about the long-term water availability. We have obviously a lot of lawns, a lot of people, as you were just saying, you know, watering even in relative drought conditions, and we don't really have a lot of rules. And this past winter, Some of our roads were starting to use salt, where in the past we've had an unwritten rule not to do that. But, you know, again, this pressure from local residents to have, you know, bare pavement even in winter conditions. And, you know, we also have some in town who have started to dig wells even deeper than what would, you know, typical, that has been, you know, down to 1,000 feet, and have been told that they can't really go any deeper.
So, Heather, you seem to be saying that there's a lack of regulatory oversight in terms of water quality. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I guess it's a concern I have, and how, you know, you can make some impact locally, but I could also see the need for something more statewide.
All right, Heather, thanks for calling in. What do you think, Denise?
That's a really interesting question, because you're dealing with people on wells and how, you know, how far should state regulation go, and what's the partnership of the state with the locality, with the municipality. So that's where you get into the legalities and how far should we go with this question of regulation. I think a big part of this is education. And, you know, many people are moving to New Hampshire. Even people who've lived here all their lives haven't often thought about their wells like we need to today, because there's more development pressure on our state, particularly in certain sections of it. So I think we really, a big part of this is about education. I mean, lawns are designed to go dormant in dry weather. They will come back when it's wet, and you can let a lawn go dormant.
Well, them's fighting words for some people, Denise.
That's right. If it's, you know, if it's not green, watch out, you know. But I mean, so in some ways that's we need to rethink some of our habits, our ways of doing things. And adaptability is what it's all about for human beings. If we're going to adapt to changing conditions in our weather and in our population growth and stuff, we're going to have to develop some new habits about how we use water.
Well, and the listening sessions haven't started yet, but given that you all, or excuse me, that John and Denise are on this commission, John, what do you think just broadly about Heather's point that, you know, there seems to be some confusion about rules and regulations regarding water use, and she seems to be saying, you know, people just do what they want.
Well, it's been a state where there's always been a lot of freedom to use your property the way you see fit. There hasn't been a lot of regulatory interference with private properties, and I think that's reflected in some of the political structures that we have, where towns are really the governing entity in terms of what happens within the locality. And there is this tension between trying to manage things so that there's a consistency across the state, but you're not sort of imposing things from some sort of upper level, which triggers a very negative response on the part of a lot of individuals. So it's compounded by the fact that water occurs in watersheds, and it's not going to respect political boundaries.
As Denise said, water doesn't respect those boundaries. It flows all along and in its own way. You mentioned infrastructure earlier, John, and we'll talk about that after a short break. We'll keep taking your calls, too, so join us at 1-800-892-6477.
Online at wordofmouthradio.org, an internist reflects on why doctors don't always tell the truth.
I think it was the human condition of it just being impossible to look at a young woman, and at the time we were the same age, mid-30s, with young children, both of us, and to tell what feels like your mirror image, that you have a disease and that you will die from this.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth's full disclosure of new ideas, online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, providing online health tools and podcasts for a healthier New Hampshire. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.org. And from Froehling Energy, displaying their new pellet boiler system in the Peterborough Townhouse during the Greenboro Green Living Expo, Saturday, May 5th, 10 till 4. Froehlingenergy.com. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the challenge of ensuring clean and plentiful water supplies for the Granite State over the next quarter century. That's the job of Governor Lynch's Water Sustainability Commission. Two of the commission's members join us this hour, as well as a professional from the Department of Environmental Services who works on water issues. We're looking at what some of the problems and challenges are facing our water supplies here in the Granite State. And we want to hear from you. What issues do you see surrounding water resources in your area? What solutions do you see to some of those problems? Is it public investment, more money? Are there attitudes that could be changed or regulations that might be changed that you think would help? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, the Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. And before we go back to our listeners, John Gilbert, I did want to ask you about infrastructure since you raised it a couple minutes ago. We hear again and again and again that our water treatment systems, our pipes need upgrades. And we hear again and again and again that communities don't have enough money to address this. So how do we get out of this circle, John?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure that we have the answer to that. You know, that you had said that the water infrastructure in the state got a grade of C-. Well, that's actually good, oddly enough, and it's better than the national average. And I can say that Manchester recently won an award, a national award for the best water quality, you know, that's provided through their system. So, you know, we're probably doing as well as anybody. But the systems are old, and the last time that there was a major investment made in our water infrastructure was really in the 1970s, and a lot of those things were federally funded at the time. There's very little prospect of any kind of federal funding at this point going forward, and a lot of those things have reached the end of their design life and or they've reached their design capacity, so they need to be upgraded and they need to be expanded in order to continue to provide the quality of outcomes that we've been achieving over the last, you know, 25 or 30 years. So that is a huge issue that we really need to deal with. And as you say, some of the infrastructure is extremely old. It dates back even prior to the Civil War.
Wow, so that's amazing. And I've heard, and maybe Paul knows the answer to this, that just because of aging infrastructure, in this instance pipes, we lose, you know, many, 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 many gallons just through cracks and leaks and so forth, right?
Right. I don't have the numbers on that, but that's certainly the case. So a big part of water conservation is for systems to figure out where they're losing water. When it comes to the need for infrastructure investment, drinking water infrastructure investment in New Hampshire, most of it is actually for those pipes, for the distribution systems, rather than the treatment.
So what are your thoughts, Paul, on how we get out of this circle that I mentioned? You know, everybody says it needs to be fixed. My goodness, some of these pipes date back to the Civil War, which is mind-boggling. But, you know, there's other needs at the state level. You know, people with disabilities need help. There's concerns about the mental health system. We've done a bazillion shows on that. You know, how do you balance that or arrange those priorities so that we also get the drinking water infrastructure that we need?
Well, that's the million-dollar question that goes on and on. How do we pay for this? How much should the water users pay for it? And to what extent should the state or federal government be expected to help with low-interest loans or grants? There used to be an awful lot of federal money available for water infrastructure. And as you know, the philosophies are changing in terms of the role of government and how much money government ought to be putting into that.
So our water bills might have to go up.
That's
we,
right.
The user, might have to pay.
Water users will probably have to take on more of the cost. And the thing is, it's the larger systems, such as Manchester, tend to be well-managed. And so they're doing a good job of keeping on top of that. It's the smaller systems that tend to have more problems. And in New Hampshire, we're a state with lots of small water systems. We've got 700 community water systems in New Hampshire. And when we look at the costs, the infrastructure investment needs, 3/4 of what we need for drinking water is needed for small systems in New Hampshire.
Talking about the users paying, it reminds me of your analogy toward gasoline, that the price goes up and then people have to decide how they're going to conserve or how they're going to use water differently. I'm guessing you have some thoughts on this, Denise, this idea of infrastructure and the huge amount of money it'll take to get it up to snuff, so to speak.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, expand the idea that it's also beyond money. It's about public health. And many of us have forgotten that in this country, that this is what started the public water movement, was there so many waterborne diseases like typhus and typhoid. We've forgotten about them. And people would have die in massive epidemics from this. So our public water is about public health. The other thing in New Hampshire that we're dealing with is that small water systems, I think it's any water system that serves more than 15 people or 10 people more than 6 months of the year, has to meet the same Environmental Protection Agency standards as Boston or as Manchester. So the smaller systems are under great pressure to upgrade. And with the funding being different, we used to rely on the federal government for a lot, but that's dropped by more than 50% just in the last 30 years. Some states are looking to some creative alternatives. I think it's Rhode Island has a trust fund just for water infrastructure, and that might be something to look at. The other idea was Vermont last year had a bill in its legislature to tax bottled water to provide for a water trust fund, since that was water going out of the state. And that's, I think that still might be floating around in their legislative session the way it works. So people are looking at some creative alternatives as well.
John Gilbert, real quick to you and then back to our listeners.
Yeah, I think one thought to offer on this is that it's easy to look at a very large number aggregated together for all of the systems in the state and to think, oh, my
it's
heavens,
impossible.
There's
it's
no way
big.
We can do it. But I think the way to start thinking about it is that we chip away at it and we start looking for a combination of public-private partnerships, bonding agencies, you know, the trust funds concepts, and we just start chipping away at it.
Well, let's go outside New Hampshire for a minute. And Susan's calling in from York, Maine. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Just speaking about public health, the natural water systems from air to ground to the kitchen water faucet are all connected. And I always think about what I put back into the water system in terms of chemicals, laundry detergent, lawn chemicals, cleaning supplies, shampoo, that sort of thing, and feel that it's really a civic responsibility to consider how we interact with the water system at that level.
Thanks a lot for that call, Susan. What do you think? I'll turn to you, Paul, I think.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking about drinking water source protection, which is actually my specialty, so maybe I should say don't get me started. But Susan has a great point. I mean, we all have a responsibility to make sure that the water that's moving through the water cycle is, that, you know, that we're being responsible in terms of not just using it, but preventing its contamination. And we were talking about water conflict a little earlier, but I think we also should remember that water can also be a source of cooperation as well as conflict. And people need to work together in watersheds and so forth because, as we said earlier, water doesn't respect the political boundaries. We need to look at what the natural watershed boundaries are and then work with people and other towns within the watershed in order to make sure that what we share is being protected.
Do you want to jump in there, Denise, too?
There's some really good efforts at cooperation and working together. We have the Southeast Watershed Alliance that was set up by the legislature that put communities, about 30 communities together that all relate to the Great Bay watershed. We also in New Hampshire are fortunate to have many local river associations and lake associations that serve as an on-the-ground, you know, on-the-water kind of, you know, providing feedback to the state, calling when they think there's a problem, and that kind of back and forth and that kind of citizen engagement is really critical to protecting our water quantity and quality for the future.
You're right. There are groups who have people who are deeply committed to their local water supply, be it a lake or a river or pond or so forth. Thank you for that call. Let's take another one. This is Scott in Amherst. Hi, Scott. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, I think that trying to do control of our water system is just the next step in more government control. That right now we've got so many regulations that interfere with our use of our land. I would like to put a little lake on my land, and I have to go through local, state, federal, all of these regulations in order to just put a lake on my land. And now you're talking about restricting or telling me how I can use the water on my land.
So it's a property rights issue for you, Scott.
Yeah, it is. You know, I bought the land. Why can't I use the brook and the well that I have to the way that I think is best for me and my family.
Well, and this is interesting, and Scott, and you probably heard Paul talk earlier about, you know, water conflicts have gone back many, 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 many years. What about the idea, though, Scott, I want to know what you think, that Denise raised earlier, which is, yeah, it's on your land, but it also flows into the other guy's land, and it, you know, has to do with the overall quality of water in your community. I wonder what you think about that.
I'm not sure. I think that that is a important consideration, but I also think that there is already not much of a very good balance between my rights and my neighbor's rights. How do you balance between you know, making somebody do what's best for their neighbor versus doing what's best for them? I mean, it, and this is totally unrelated, but it's similar, is the, you know, smoking in public kind of a thing.
Yeah,
it's best for the person to have their choice, but, you know, why interfere with other people's choice also for what
right.
they feel is best for them.
Well, Scott, this is really interesting, and thank you for calling. And boy, folks, this is the fundamental question, isn't it, Paul? I'll turn to you first, since you mentioned water conflicts. It's his property. He wants to do what he wants to do with it.
Well, right. And but Laura, you've made a great point about how it's all connected. What he does could affect it. His neighbors, people downstream, and so forth. If he had wildlife moving across his land, that doesn't mean that all the deer on his land belong to him. But it's interesting that Scott also recognizes, with the smoking analogy, that he does need to respect what the impacts are going to be on neighbors, and it's a matter of balancing his rights with the public's rights.
So how do you figure that out? Is that ever possible, especially in a state that really values property rights like New Hampshire?
Well, it sure is difficult. I mean, as you know, and as Denise alluded to, a lot of the decisions that affect our water resources, even the regulatory decisions, are made on the local level rather than the state level. Land use decisions, subdivision, design of commercial sites, these are all decisions that are made on the local level. And so we need to look forward and figure out how we're going to preserve everybody's rights and respect everybody, but make sure that our common interests in having water, enough clean water, is going to be achieved in the future.
This is a fundamental question that Scott's asking. Thanks a lot, Scott. Go ahead, John.
I think one of the ways to think about this is we talk a lot about rights, but I think we need to talk about rights and responsibilities, because no property is an island. And we all exist in connection with one another, and we exist in community with one another. And I think that, you know, while Scott is talking about his rights to do what he wishes on his land, what if the guy who is upgrading it or upstream from him decides that he wants to be able to throw away his old gasoline from his lawnmower into the water, and that ends up in Scott's well? I mean, that, you know, that's a point at which, you know, the question starts to become very pointed. And I think there is very much this tension, and I think it's one of the things we're trying to get at with the New Hampshire Listens process, is what are the values? You know, what is that balance of rights versus responsibilities, and what is the best level at which to manage that?
Well, and Scott, if you or anyone listening right now, again, wants to attend one of these meetings, they start next Tuesday. There's information on our website, nhpr.org, as well as on our Facebook page if you do want to attend. And Denise, you know, Scott's call also reminds me of the woman who called earlier who'd moved here from Utah, and she had some of the same frustrations. Look, this is my resource and I want to use it.
I think, as John said, we're not islands, and we're not just our well, and there's nobody else putting their straw down into the aquifer too. There's many straws in the aquifer, and we have to understand that and learn to work together as a community so that it's there for our children and our children's children, and for all the wildlife and aquatic life that needs it, and the plant life. So we're living and we're part of an ecosystem, and most of us need to learn a little bit more about that. I will say, though, I can understand Scott's frustration with wanting to maybe put some sort of a man, it sounds like a man-made lake or something on his land, and then encountering all this paperwork he has to go through from level to level. And I've heard this in a number of places where I've spoken around New Hampshire, and sometimes what I think is we almost need, we need like an ombudsman at the state level to assist. We have it to assist business to get through the permitting process, but as far as I'm aware, we don't seem to have something like that for your everyday community residents. And so people go to a planning board and then they're told, okay, we'll start the planning process, but now you've got to get this permit from the state and maybe you need a federal permit. And it can be very confusing. It can be become very expensive. And it's very hard to know the process when it's your first time going through it.
All right. Well, thanks again for that call, Scott. And here's an email that just came in. A person didn't give a name. Paul, I want to see if you know about this. This person asks, what about the unknown perils of fracking on wells like mine? And we've heard a lot about this lately, and we're planning a show on it next week. Paul or Denise, any thoughts there?
I have worked on the fracking issue.
You have?
You have, yeah. I've actually been very involved with that through my prior work in New York State. I was working for a national nonprofit, and fracking's been a concern since 2008. There are many questions about fracking and its relationship to water and aquifer supplies because it, number one, uses millions of gallons of water mixed with hundreds of chemicals, and it was exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act in 2005. By the federal government. So it leaves the states and local communities pretty much on their own trying to figure out the science of this and what it could involve. And there are many concerns being raised.
Yeah, it's probably worth mentioning that it's possible. It's not clear what the emailer is asking about, whether they're asking about hydrofracking of a water supply well, which is something we've been doing for a long time. Not aware of any huge issues with that, or the fracking that is being done for gas development in other states. And as Denise said, there are a lot of environmental issues around that.
All right. Well, just to wrap it up again, you're kicking off your meetings next Tuesday, and then John Gilbert, a report due in September
of this year?
All right. That's correct. Well, we'll wait the results, and I want to thank all three of you very much for coming in. John, thank you for being here.
It's very much my pleasure. Thank you.
John Gilbert, Chair of the Governor's Water Sustainability Commission. Denise, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Good to see you, Laura. Thank you.
Denise Hart, member of the Water Sustainability Commission, who's focusing on conservation and public engagement. And Paul Seska, thank you also for being here.
Thanks, Laura. We're just looking forward to being surprised at what we hear next week.
Paul Seska, he works on water issues at New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. And one more time, if you want more information about these meetings, our website, NHPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern's Ryan Lassar. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.